continue with our series of Why Should I Believe? This is a continuation of Lesson 11, which will be our final lesson. Before I get there, just a reminder that there are resources that are out there on my website for this entire series. This I think will be the last lesson unless somebody comes up and says, hey, could you talk about X? I think this one's going to be the last lesson. Whether that means I finish it tonight or not, I don't know. But on the site, teamag.com/believe2024, we've spilled into 2025 a little bit. But I've got all the slides, even through this lesson. I've got all links to all of the audio of the lessons, which Jeff and Mike record, and Jeff puts them on the Pleasant View website. And then for all but one, I have the video for the lesson. The reason why I don't have the one is because for whatever reason, we recorded it and Facebook muted it. I don't know why. So if you just want to watch me look like a puppet up here in front of everybody, you can watch that, but you're not going to get any sound. So I don't have that one linked. But all the other ones are on there. I don't have last week's yet linked on that site. It's available on Facebook, but I don't yet have that link. And by the way, you don't have to have a Facebook account to watch the videos on Facebook. So I said, so he's like, hey, I'm not on Facebook. If you go and click on a link that takes you to Facebook, it will. I've got it set to not make you have to have an account. So you should be able to watch all those videos if you're interested in any of that, having that as a resource. Tonight, as I said, we're going to continue with Lesson 11, which is the problem of hell. And just as a quick recap, what is the problem of hell? The problem of hell is the question, how can a loving God send people to an eternal hell, to eternal punishment? As I said last week, I think this is one of the big reasons, not the only reason, clearly not the only reason, but a big reason why a lot of folks reject the God of the Bible. Say, hey, how could there be a God that would do that? You claim that God is love, but yet you also talk about the reality of hell. How can those two things coexist? I can't believe in a God who would do that. And we looked last week at, I picked one particular writer who had written a book or pamphlet sharing his thoughts on that conundrum, if you will, and essentially saying, that's why I've rejected God. I don't believe in God because these two things can't coexist. From that last week, we talked about problems with the problem. This entire lesson is structured as five problems with the problem of hell. We got through three last week. I will do a quick recap of those three just for those of you that were not here. Even for those of you that were here, I don't expect you to remember everything I talked about. But we'll do a quick recap with, you know, problems with the problem. And by the way, I've said this probably more times than anybody's wanted to hear, but what's the reason why we go through this? What's the reason why we have this series? And from the very beginning, I've looked at it as twofold, okay? Maybe even threefold. One is for ourselves. Because just because we have accepted Christ, and again, looking out here, the majority have accepted Christ, doesn't mean that we are immune from having questions, from having doubts, from coming across things that we wrestle with in our mind and we can't get past. And for some, that causes them to let go of their faith. That can also happen to folks that we know, maybe even in our own family, maybe even our children or our grandchildren. And sometimes we may need to have difficult conversations with them, even if they're not willing to ask the questions. And can we be equipped to have those conversations? But then the third place is, these are questions that we encounter in day-to-day life. You know, I have to believe at some point during these 11 lessons, divided over however many Sunday nights, I don't know how many it's been total, quite a few, surely we've gone over a topic that has come up in conversation with a member of your family, an extended family, somebody at work, casual conversation, whatever. How do you respond if someone says, well, I can't believe in a God who would send people to hell? What do you say? What do you say? How do you have that conversation with somebody? And so thinking about problems with the problem is really designed to deal with all three of those possibilities. Self, those that are close to us, or having conversations with others. And hopefully this will help do that. First problem. The first problem with the problem of hell is that it is not an isolated problem. It can't be isolated from all the other evidence for God in the Bible. You know, through this series, we've gone through a lot. And I had a slide up last time kind of listing out all the topics that we've covered. Starting off looking at, you know, well, is there anything else that can give us a reason for why we're here, why we exist? Talk about the holes in some of those attempted explanations. We looked at evidence that the Bible is reliable. We looked at arguments for the existence of God, like the moral argument. You know, where did the concept of right and wrong come from if we were only just a series of random chance occurring? Where did right and wrong, where did good and evil, where did they come from? We've talked about evidence for the resurrection. You may think, well, how can we possibly have evidence for the resurrection? There's actually quite a bit of evidence for the resurrection. That the reason why the tomb was empty, which is not a debated topic, not in the scholarly world. No one tries to say, hey, the tomb was never empty. No, the tomb was empty. Because if the tomb wasn't empty, they would have produced the body when people started claiming that he had walked out of that tomb. The tomb was empty. And there's a lot of evidence that the reason why the tomb was empty is because Jesus came out of it. We talked about a lot of things. But just because we may have a question about the existence of an eternal hell doesn't make all those other things go away. And so again, this is not a problem that can be considered in isolation. The second problem we talked about is that this is a problem based on feelings. Okay? And last week I asked the question, how many of you like the idea of an eternal punishment? And shockingly, no one raised their hand. It's not something we like to think about, right? It's not comfortable. We don't like it. And if you remember, again, that philosopher that I read from last week, that he, in his quotes that I had from his pamphlet, he said, I feel like, I think that. It was based on feelings. We don't like the concept of punishment, but there's a difference between, the way we feel can't change something that's true. The question is not, do we like the idea of hell? The question is, does hell exist? Whether we like it or not doesn't change if it's real. And I talked about that song on that Beatles album that I've had several of you say, hey, I've gone and listened to that. It's complete and utter garbage. Yes, I gave you a warning, okay? Everybody's like telling me, like, I can't believe it's actually that bad. Like, I told you it was that bad. I told you. I even had somebody said, hey, I knew before the words even came out of your mouth which song you were going to say. Hey, it's bad. It's awful. And I love the Beatles. It's awful. But it doesn't, the fact that I don't like it doesn't take it off the album. Doesn't change it. It still exists. Okay, the way we feel about something doesn't change fact. Doesn't change truth. The third thing that we talked about, and this is where we're getting into the meat of this conversation. I mentioned that in preparing for this lesson, which we had not done a lesson in this series since mid-December when I did this one last week. And I've spent more time on this one than any of the others. And one of the reasons why is not that it's a complicated answer, but that truly answering it requires kind of going back to the absolute fundamentals of what Christianity represents and what God represents. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about the nature of God. And I'm not just, I mean, thinking based on study, not just like, Tim, what do I believe is the name? No. What I study. God is mysterious. And I said this last week, and I've said it before in other times. there are things we are never going to know about God or understand about God, at least on this side of eternity. But there are things that God has chosen to reveal about himself that we can know. And one of the things he has revealed about himself is that he cannot be united with sin. And we looked at 1 John 1 among other passages. But that, you know, John, who says God is light, using the metaphor of light, which is pretty common in the Bible, especially with John, has John begin his gospel. He says, in him was light, meaning Jesus, and that light was the life of men. He says, God is light, and in him is no darkness at all. And he says, you know, how can we say we have fellowship with him when we walk in the darkness? God cannot be united with sin. So what does that have to do with this conversation about the reality of hell? Well, what happened in the garden? We sinned, right? God said, if you do this one thing, if you eat of this tree, what did he say? You will surely die. Right? So what do? We ate of the tree. And everyone since then is not guilty of Adam's sin. Everyone since then has sinned. Guilty on their own, right? And what are the consequences of that sin? We are separated from God. Why? Why? Because God's nature, God in his nature cannot be united with sin. Okay? That is a reality of the nature of the God that we serve. Okay? Now, that brings us to number four. That's where we got to last week. Okay? By far, the first three are the shortest three. Whether I will get through four and five tonight, I don't know, because there's a lot in here. Okay? Number four is also a nature of God topic, though I don't have it necessarily worded that way, but here's the way I worded it. The problem does not recognize, meaning the problem of hell. How could a loving God send people to an eternal hell? The problem does not recognize that God's perfect justice demands punishment for wrongdoing. And again, as I just said, this is another one of those things that is part of the nature of God. God, not only is he sinless, he cannot be united with sin. So there's a division. When there's sin, there's a division. But God, in his nature, is just. Okay? It's just. Okay, well, what does it mean to be just? It means everything about him is just or is based on a system of justice. Everything. You know, think about, we'll talk about this passage later, but in 1 John 4, John says God is love, right? That doesn't mean that some of the things that God does are because of his love. What does that mean? Everything about God and that God does is because he is love. Again, not that some of his activities are loving activities. No, everything about him is love. Okay, God is just. Not that sometimes he demands justice. No, his nature requires justice. And that means that if there is a wrong, if there's a sin, there has to be a what? A payment. He told us, if you do this, what will happen? You will surely die. It's a warning. Why? Because if God is just, his creation is built on a system of what? Justice. And so sin separates us from God, but also requires a payment. A payment. Okay? God is just. Let's talk about that from a biblical perspective. The 89th Psalm. Righteousness and justice are the foundation of your throne. Steadfast love and faithfulness go before you. Deuteronomy 32. We'll have Deuteronomy up here several times tonight. Deuteronomy, a series of speeches given by Moses before the children of Israel enter into the promised land, finally, after 40 years in the wilderness. He describes God in Deuteronomy 32 as the rock. His work is perfect, for all his ways are justice. A God of faithfulness and without iniquity, just and upright is he. You sensing a pattern? He's just. Okay? He's just. Many, when you think about this idea of justice, I don't know of anybody that has a problem with a God who forgives. Right? No one's complaining like, how could you dare serve a God who forgives? Right? What's the problem with? The problem is with a God who punishes. The problem is with a God who punishes. But Adam and Eve sinned in the garden, and everyone since then has sinned. And Paul said that in Romans 5. He doesn't say that we're guilty of Adam's sin. He said because of Adam's sin, all who came after him have sinned. And the result of that sin is death. Okay? Now, would justice be served if God allowed sin to go unpunished? Would that be a system of justice? Would that meet the requirements of justice? If God did not allow sin, if God did not punish sin? But you have to understand, that's a question, as Paul might say, from a human perspective, because that concept doesn't even exist with God. You understand what I'm saying? Because he is just. There is no reality where God allows sin to go without a payment. Does that make sense? This means yes, this means no. You guys are kind of looking at me like you're a bug flying in a bug zapper. Okay? You with me? Does that make sense? This is a question just to make us think, because there's no concept of God allowing the sin to just be, poof, it's gone. Otherwise, he would have never had to send himself to die on a cross. Right? That concept doesn't exist because God is just. That's his nature. If there's sin, what does there have to be? A payment. What is the payment that he warned us we were going to have to pay if we sinned? You're going to die. And we did it anyway. So would justice be served if God allowed sin to go unpunished? No, it wouldn't. Which means that God can't do that. He can't do it. It's not his nature. God is impartial. We don't serve a God who is going to say, well, you over here, you're going to be punished, but you over here, who also have sin that hasn't been cleansed, I'm just not going to punish you. You don't have to pay. And I'm talking about the absence of the blood of Christ, obviously. Okay? Don't go out here and say, Tim says there's no forgiveness of sins no matter what. No, we're not talking about the gospel. We're talking about the nature of God. Do we believe that we serve a God who judges all the same? I do. Moses, again, Deuteronomy. I told you we were going to have some Deuteronomy tonight. I bet you it's on your bingo card tonight, right? We're going to get a lot of Deuteronomy tonight. Moses, Deuteronomy 1, talking to the current generation about how to make judgments. He says what? Don't be partial in your judgment. And what is he advocating they do? Reflect the judgment of the God that you serve. Don't be partial in your judgments. Look at Deuteronomy 10. For the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great, the mighty, and the awesome God who is not partial and takes no bribe. It's all equal. Why? Because God is just. If there's sin, there's consequences. There's payment. That's justice. It's not just an Old Testament thing. Colossians. Chapter 3, written by Paul. I think of Colossians as like the sister letter of Ephesians. I don't remember how long it's been. We did a long study of Ephesians on Sunday morning. I didn't jump into Colossians because we'd be repeating a lot of the same things. But in Colossians, when he's in a section talking about what is similar in Ephesians, which is kind of slaves and masters, servants and masters, that relationship, in that he says, whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord and not for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive an inheritance as your reward. You are serving the Lord Christ, for the wrongdoer will be paid back for the wrong he has done, and there is no, what? Partiality. Same thing Moses said, right? There's no partiality. Now, I want us to take this concept of justice, and I want us to take it from a divine level and bring it down to a local level. And by local level, I mean on this planet. Okay? Which could mean our day-to-day life. Or it could mean things that we see happening in our city or our neighborhood, or things that we see happening in our country, or things that we see happening in our world. Okay? Most of us have a strong desire for justice to be served in this life. Right? Is that a true statement? Most of us want justice to be served in this life. Right? Again, start with personal. I'm wronged in some way. What's my human instinct? I want justice. Right? Vindicate, call it whatever. Vindication, revenge, whatever. I want it to be made right. Okay? Things happen in a city level, a country level. We see things that we perceive happening, maybe not to us, but around us. We see things happening that we do not believe are just. What do we want? We want justice. There are people all over the world crying for justice. Right? I'm not talking about divine. I'm talking about here. And I think my perception is, which may not be reality, because I've never lived in any country other than the United States, where whatever we think of our government, we have a pretty structured government. Again, whatever we think of it, it's pretty structured compared to other places, right? Where there's either a very loose government or no government at all. They're not looking for government to bring them justice because there's no one to bring it. Right? But all this to say, we have this desire here for justice. We have this desire here for justice. Where does that desire in us come from? Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion. Again, verse 27, God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. We are created in the image of God. And I think as those who have been created in the image of God, we have justice written on our hearts. I don't mean that that's part of our nature in the way in which God has it as part of his nature, but if we are the imprint, the image of God, we have it written on our hearts. A desire for justice. A desire for justice. When you think about, again, many in the world, or maybe even most in the world, would say, we want justice. You know, whatever that is, whatever that looks like. There's people all over the world that are crying for justice. Why does that not carry over to seeking divine justice? Want justice here. Want to be vindicated here, want the government to come to my rescue, whatever it is, but I don't want to consider the concept of eternal punishment for those who are doing wrong. You follow where I'm going here? Taking the veil off of the earth, now we're thinking about, in the terms of Ecclesiastes, above the sun. Why does this not carry over to divine justice? Divine's tough because it's eternal, right? It's eternal. And we cry out for injustice in the world, but God's final judgment will bring justice for all things. All things. In all of my study for this, I came across an author who is actually, I think he still is. At one time he was, I don't know if he still is. He's actually a professor at Yale in their theology department. But his background is Croatian. He's a Croatian. And he was in the midst of numerous conflicts, wars that took place in Eastern Europe during the Soviet era, which is, they give you that as a context for the comments that you're about to read from his book. But again, a Croatian, I think he's kind of describes himself as a Croatian theologian, but he's a professor at Yale, or at least he was a professor at Yale. And this is one of his, he's written a bunch of books. If you go look up his name, Miroslav Volf, go type that in Amazon, he's got a whole bunch of books. I guess to be a professor at Yale, you got to write a lot of books. You know, you got to have a lot of things published. But in this book called Exclusion and Embrace, he's got this. And he says, the whole concept of this chapter is the idea of justice. The idea of justice. And having been a part, again, living in, growing up in Eastern Europe amidst all the conflict, again, of the Soviet era, he's speaking from experience here. And he's imagining a situation where people are clamoring for justice and asking a question of what would you tell them about justice? And here's the situation. He says, I suggest imagining that you are delivering a lecture in a war zone. Now, if there's a war, that implies at least two parties are involved, right? Maybe more. Okay? He says, among your listeners are people whose cities and villages have been first plundered, then burned, and leveled to the ground, whose daughters and sisters have been defiled, whose fathers and brothers have their throats slit. And with that, I would add on to that, my little commentary. In the middle of a war zone, you probably can't even say, and it's all that side's fault that all this stuff happened. Could be either side, right? If you're in the middle of a war, stuff could have happened because of the actions of either side. And he goes on to talk about, if I'm trying to, speaking to them, I'm trying to talk to them about justice. So I have to tell them, you're not going to find justice for what has happened in this life. Like, what are you going to do as an individual? Are you going to go defeat the army of that other country? What are you going to do? What are you going to do? Are you going to find individual justice for what has happened to your life? You've had your children killed. You've lost family members. What? How are you going to find justice in this life? What are you going to tell them? What are you going to tell them? I was reading that. It just made me think. Like, there is no earthly answer, right? There's no earthly scenario in that where you go, well, you do these five things and it'll be made right. Does that make sense? Anybody still with me? You guys are like in a, you're like in a sermon coma here. Does that make sense? And he closes it out. Well, let me back up from this. It's a situation that made me think about what Paul had to say in Romans 12. Romans 12, which I sometimes call the other love chapter. The love chapter is 1 Corinthians 13. But I think of Romans 12 as the other love chapter because so much of what's written in Romans 12 is Paul talking about what the demands of love are. Said another way, what does love for God and love for neighbor look like lived out? It's one thing to talk about love as a concept, but what does love look like when you go live it out? That's a big part of what Romans 12 is all about. And in there, he says, repay no one evil for evil. Give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to what? The wrath of God, for it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay. Paul says, don't take it upon yourself to try to find justice here. Don't take it upon yourself to try to get vengeance here. What does he say? Leave it to God. Why does he say leave it to God? Because God is a God of justice. And in the end, what is God going to bring? He's going to bring justice. Right? He's going to bring justice. And so the end of this story where the writer of this book, Miroslav Volf, where he says, imagine you're talking to people who've had all these horrible things happen in the midst of a war zone, and you're trying to talk to them about the concept of justice. He says, if God were not angry at injustice and deception and did not make a final end of violence, that God would not be worthy of our worship. He said, the only thing you can talk to them about justice is that in the end, God's going to end all injustice. God's going to end all injustice. God is going to bring justice, a final justice, for everything. Yeah, you're not going to get justice here, and no amount of retaliatory violence is going to bring you justice in this world if you've been hit by this, again, in the middle of this war. But you're going to find justice in the end. And he says, if I didn't believe in a God who was going to bring final justice, if I thought that God was not going to bring final justice, I wouldn't think that God would be worthy of worship. Because we have a God who, again, by his nature cannot be joined with sin, and by his nature is just. He's just. Okay? He's just. In another book, same guy, Miroslav Volf, free of charge, he says this. He says, though I used to complain about the indecency of the idea of God's wrath, I came to think that I would have to rebel against a God who wasn't wrathful at the sight of the world's evil. God isn't wrathful in spite of being love. God is wrathful because he is love. And from that, like, God's justice is not a problem. You know, talk about the problem of hell. Maybe instead of a problem, it's a solution. For a world that is full of injustice and for a people who cry for justice to be served, we want justice. Well, guess what? God's going to bring justice. He's going to bring justice. Why? Because he's just. He's just. He's going to solve all the injustice in this world. He's going to solve it all. Does that make sense? Okay. There is going to be a part three because we have got 10 minutes left and I got more slides about problem five than I had of all the other problems combined. So, we're not going to get to it, but I'm going to give you a preview. Okay. By the way, if you want to go out there and download the slides, you can download them. You can see them. You can already see them, okay, from the slide I gave you. But here's problem five. The problem does not recognize that no one has to go to hell. No one has to go to hell. And that's what we're going to finish talking about. And this is going to be going through problem five, whether that's, it won't be next week because I will not be here next Sunday night. Jeff's filling in for me. The next Sunday after that is singing night. So maybe the one after that, who knows what's going to happen in 3 weeks. But Lord willing, that's probably when we'll do the next one. But this is going to be a review of really the fundamentals of Scripture. Because in reviewing this, we're going to talk about, from a high level, the consequences of God's sinlessness, his inability to be joined with sin, God's perfect justice. Take those two things, and you throw into that mix what? Our sin. What happens? If you have God who can't be united with sin, God who's perfectly just, and then you have our sin. If you made it into a mathematical formula, what's the result? We're separated from God, and we're going to die. Right? Why? Because God desires that everybody die? How many times in Scripture does it say the exact opposite? God wants what? Everybody to be saved. God does not want anyone to perish. But the beautiful part of this story is that God didn't just warn us what would happen if we sinned. He already had a solution to the problem of sin. And that's what we're going to look at in chapter 5. So this is going to be like almost like a gospel lesson, gospel sermon, chapter, problem 5. where we go back and re-examine the very fundamentals of who God is and what we did, and then what God already had and had planned to save us in spite of what we did. And it makes, to me, it's something, I'm not going to tell you anything, I don't think. I'm not going to go over anything that you don't already know. But I think forcing ourselves to go back and think about it from that level can remind us of how beautiful the story is. Because this is not, real preview of a slide that's coming. This is not a punishment story. It's not a punishment story. Again, the problem assumes this is a punishment story, right? How could a good God send people to hell? It assumes this is a punishment story, but it's not a punishment story. When you look at what we did, we sinned. And who God is, can't be with sin, has to have justice. What does it then become? It becomes a rescue story. A rescue story. And you go, well, then if God knew what was going to happen and we did it anyway, what did God do about it? Well, He then came and said, hey, if you don't accept this rescue, what's going to happen? You're going to spend eternity in hell. He came to warn us. You know how Jesus told Nicodemus, I didn't come to condemn the world? John 3:16-18, I didn't come to condemn the world. We looked at that 2 weeks ago, Sunday morning, or last week. I didn't come to condemn the world. The world was already condemned. Who condemned it? We did. Jesus came to rescue those who would accept His rescue. You know, I don't have the details in my head specifically, but I remember, and I've used this as a sermon illustration before. I'm going to tell this while I'm here. You want to skip those? I'll finish with this. I don't remember the details. I apologize because I had not been planning on telling this. But I remember years ago reading a story about the rescue operation during Hurricane Katrina. Those of you that are younger, if you're not familiar with that, Hurricane Katrina was a massive hurricane that hit New Orleans, Mississippi. Lots of loss of life, loss of infrastructure. But the way it occurred, especially in New Orleans, was kind of a two-phase hit. New Orleans is below sea level. It's below sea level. And the reason why water does not infiltrate New Orleans is because of levees that are built all the way around the city. And when the hurricane passed over, there wasn't a ton of damage from the initial hit. But then what happened was the levees were overwhelmed and they broke. And lots of people died in the flooding that occurred. And I was reading this story about how these National Guard, Coast Guard, that had been brought in ahead of the storm and during the storm to go in and rescue people, a lot of them by helicopter, said in the beginning parts of the storm, every time they went out, they filled up their helicopters with people and brought them back. But then once the storm came past, said every person said, no, we're good. Had no idea what was coming. They said, no, we're good. They declined rescue. Why? Because they didn't know. They didn't know there was going to be a part two, right? They declined rescue. And I was reading about that, about how over and over and over these pilots were saying, we couldn't get anybody to come with us. We beg them, we plead with them, they wouldn't come with us. And many of those that wouldn't come with them lost their lives. What God is offering us is rescue from not a future that's future death that's possible. He's offering us rescue from a future death that is certain. And there's only one hope of rescue, and He's God. He's got it. And guess what? He's had it since before the beginning of time. If you're here tonight, you've never accepted God's invitation to be rescued by the blood of His Son, by the action that God Himself took when He came to this earth and died for us. why not start that tonight? Why not accept that tonight? If there's anything else we can do for you, please come while Mike leads us in our invitations.